This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we share a few moments to review the recent film Vice.
It's a monster flick. Check it out.
We also speak with Johanna Fernandez about a break in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
When I think of Mumia and the 38 years I think that he's been in prison, what a magnificent person he is, like Frederick Douglass, really. And he's now got a chance to get out. We speak with the person who's been instrumental in getting him that chance.
We also speak with Ajamu Baraka about President Trump's recent withdrawal of troops from Syria. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, over the holiday weekend, I got a little caught up on my movie going, and I saw Christian Bale's tour de force performance in the movie Vice. Now, I know you saw it too, and what were your reactions?
Well, it was a real life monster flick, wasn't it?
Yes.
And Christian Bale, he looked just like Chaney.
On The Voice. Amazing.
And tilting his head to the side and that crooked smile and that sneering attitude.
He was amazing.
It was brilliant. I think it's an Academy Award nominee.
I do too. Now, I must say that we're going to have a few minutes of host chat, and this discussion is going to contain spoilers for those of you who may want to see the film.
Well, the only spoiler is that it's pretty accurate about what the monster did. You know that going into it. The film just lays it out.
And so, Michael, can I just say something? Did you have the same feeling as I did? Watching the movie, it covered so many topics that we've discussed on Law and Disorder.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
I know.
It was like a repeat of our radio show from years ago when we started out. For example, habeas corpus. Getting rid of habeas corpus is the ancient right to be told what the charges are against you and brought before a judge so you can defend yourself. That was one of the first things they wiped out. Separation of powers, what the founding fathers sanctified. That was the way to keep a democracy on the rails, that you had an independent judiciary and that the executive was separate from the legislature, and there was kind of a balance between the three of them. This one, under Cheney's guidance, came up with the theory of what was called the unitary executive.
Right. That was really, I thought, the guiding theme of the film.
Yeah, the unitary executive.
And
exactly.
That means, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it just means that whatever the president does, by definition, has to be legal. That was an idea that Nixon came up with, and these guys expanded it.
The scene that I thought quite compelling was in a boardroom with John Yoo and others, where they talked about basically to adhere to the unitary executive theory, rewriting legal memos, which are still on the books, by the way, still available for people to use now, describing torture in a way that robs it of its evil and unlawfulness.
John Yoo was a lawyer in the Office of Legal Counsel advising the president, and what they did was they say torture is not torture. They said unless it amounts to the same thing as organ failure, whatever you do to a guy, it's not torture.
And essentially, they also said that anything the president does, and this was key, anything, if the president does it, it's legal.
They're the unitary executive. And also, they undermined congressional duty under our Constitution. Congress has to declare war. They obviated that one. And the abrogation of the Fourth Amendment, the right of privacy. You can't have a democracy without the right of privacy. And we later learned when Snowden revealed what was going on was that the federal government was listening into every phone call, was tapping every keystroke on your computer. They knew everything that was going on, and then they lied about it.
Michael, can we talk about, before we go back to some of the politics, the actual film itself? Now, there were some scenes. My favorite was the restaurant scene where Rumsfeld, Cheney, and two others were at a ritzy restaurant with an elaborate menu. And it had on it, for example, such entrees as Extraordinary Rendition. It was hilarious. I thought that was really well done.
Yeah, they interwove, and I think in a movie like this, which is essentially really grim, because what they're talking about is trashing the rule of law, but they interwove humor into it. I thought that was good. I thought the other thing that was really funny was when Bush calls Cheney down to the ranch because he's looking for a running mate. And he lays it out to Cheney. And Cheney says, well, I've been the chief executive of a major oil corporation, and I've been this, and I've been secretary of defense, you know, I've been all these things. And I don't, you know, vice president, it's a nothing job. Truman said it wasn't worth a bucket of spit. So Cheney complains, and he says, if I'm going to take the gig, then you got to let me do this, 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 and this, essentially taking all the reins of power into his own hands. And Bush, this lightweight, says, hot damn, let's do it. You got it.
Yeah, that was a key scene, and again, sort of summed up. I thought Sam Rockwell was genius as George W. Bush. In fact, the whole casting was superb.
Perfect. How about Lynn Cheney?
Oh, Lynn Cheney. Well, I hadn't really known all that much about Lynn Cheney before, but to me, she was kind of the evil behind the scenes driving force, especially vis-a-vis their daughter's gay marriage.
She was a real Lady Macbeth.
She was Lady Macbeth.
She was the one that told. Cheney was a washout. He got to Yale. He was a drunk. They kicked him out. He came home. He was working as a line repairman in Wyoming. And she told him, look, either you straighten up or I'm leaving you. And that was the turning point.
You know, I wonder if you had the same reaction when the opening scene of that film, which was excellent, I actually thought that was going to be George W. Bush falling drunk out of a bar and getting into his car and then getting into an accident. Yeah, I had no idea about Cheney's early days.
Yeah, I didn't either.
And the fact that Lynn whipped him into shape.
Yeah, but let's talk about the you know, they had two daughters.
Yes.
Ultimately, one of them was betrayed. She was lesbian. She was in a gay relationship with another woman. The issue of gay marriage was on the agenda in Wyoming.
Well, what did you think of the device, before we get to that, where there's a false ending to the film? I was a little confused at first by that.
Yeah, I was a little confused.
So they rolled the credits, and they ended it at the point where Cheney made a decision, because his daughter had come out to the family as being gay after her girlfriend broke up with her and she was crying, Cheney decided to leave politics because he didn't want to betray his daughter's lifestyle by campaigning against gay marriage.
Yeah, I thought, well, good for him. I didn't know that about
him. So did I, yeah. But then we realized that wasn't the real ending.
Do the spoiler. What was the real ending?
Well, the spoiler was, of course, that the one daughter ran for and became an elected official and came out publicly disparaging gay marriage, which devastated the other daughter.
Yeah.
And Lynn Cheney supported her in doing that.
I think both of them did, but the movie showed that Lynn did. But I think, because in the movie it said that they had to give this the green light, so they betrayed one daughter for the political power career of
yes,
the other daughter.
Although, just to be really precise, I think that it was Lynn's driving force, and that was the one kind of human thing I thought that they showed about Dick, is that he was always quiet when the topic arose and sort of looking introspective. So I think that he would have put family first.
Yeah, exactly. What about Colin Powell speaking about good casting?
Okay. Oh, my God. Tyler Perry. I didn't know that till after. What a great job he did.
Yeah. Well, he made that lion speech to the United Nations with evidence, so-called evidence, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And that's what turned the thing around and paved the way for the war.
Yep.
And it turned out to be all BS.
Yeah, yeah.
And he later on said that was a low point in his career.
I think the film hit on the major areas. They spliced a few scenes of the real photos of torture into it, which I thought was very effective.
Yeah.
And, quite honestly, it really did remind me back when Michael Ratner was with us and working on a lot of these issues, as well as the Center for Constitutional Rights. We really had a textbook of all the key issues that were challenging the Constitution on a daily basis.
Exactly. And even going back further than that, I thought what was really good in the movie was they talked about the project for the New American Century,
yes,
the think tank,
yes,
that Cheney was on with a bunch of the other people in the movie. And this think tank cooked up the idea of attacking Iraq.
Yes.
In 1998, 3 years before 9/11, they wrote a letter to President Clinton saying, you've got to militarily attack Iraq. They had their eyes set on Iraq's oil treasures. Remember, Cheney was the head of Halliburton, a major oil company.
And I'm glad they brought that up as well. And when a couple of other officials confronted Cheney and said, isn't this, in essence, a conflict? He said no, and they just shut the discussion short.
Yeah,
but
let's talk about that Leahy, Senator Leahy, the senator from
our hero,
Vermont. Buttonholes Cheney in the Senate, says, you know, I had to expose this because Halliburton had a no-bid contract. They really had their hands in the till.
Right.
And they were making hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars off the war because Cheney paved the way for that. And Leahy called him on it, and Cheney said, go F yourself.
Yes. Well, Michael, I also like the scenes of the attacks of 9/11, where obviously they used real footage, because to that point of laying the groundwork for more war, you saw Cheney's face during the attack and knew that he was thinking, this is an opportunity.
That's precisely what the Project for a New American Century called for. In the paper it said, and I'm going to quote, their Declaration of Principles for the Project of New American Century said what they needed was, quote, a catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. So for them, 9/11 was heaven sent, and once the attack took place, the first thing Cheney said was, blame it on Iraq. Find out how we can blame this on Iraq. Attack Iraq. Then, of course, they went on, they attacked Afghanistan to soften people up for it, and 2 years later, they went on and attacked Iraq.
Back to the structure of the film, I love the scene where Cheney first gets a closet-like office, no window. He's sitting there, and he calls Lynn, all excited, and you can sort of see the two of them relishing the fact that he has his own office.
Well, the camel's nose was under the tent. The guy had a little office in the White House. Yep. That was the beginning of it.
That was the beginning.
He became the consummate bureaucrat. He really knew how to work the levers of power in Washington. He was brilliant
at
it.
In a quiet way, and that was what was so insidious, the amount of power that he took stealthily, and that, I think, can describe a lot of the operations of the government.
Yeah,
ever since then and that now. We could go on and on about this, but what rating, if you were a film critic, would you give this?
Well, I'm throwing Rotten Tomatoes,
and
I'd give it a 10 for 10. It's a great movie. People should go see it. They'll understand current American history if they look at it. It's a real monster flick.
And I would give it a 10 for 10 as well, and I just want to say that I've read some of the reviews, which are not as praiseworthy as ours. And I think some of the critiques I've seen are that it's not a true biopic, in that it doesn't explain really the deeper character of Cheney.
Well, it explains the history. The person that wrote the movie did his research. For example, reading Jane Mayer's Dark Money. They really knew what they're talking about. This is historically an accurate movie.
And we give it a collective 10. We are pleased to begin the new year with a major development that might pave the way for freedom for former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal, the award-winning journalist convicted in the 1981 murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. In late December, a Philadelphia Common Pleas Court judge ruled that Mumia can re-argue his appeal in the case before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The decision hinges on a recent Supreme Court decision with similar facts. Then-presiding Chief Justice Ron Castile failed to excuse himself due to his prior role as Philadelphia District Attorney in Mumia's early appeal. Mumia's attorney argued that Castile made statements related to persons accused of killing police officers that indicated he should have recused himself. His campaign speeches and letters urge capital punishment in police killing cases. As we've long reported, Mumia spent nearly three decades on death row before his sentence was thrown out over flawed jury instructions. In 2001, prosecutors agreed to a sentence of life without parole. Judge Leon Tucker's decision this past December was split. He denied Mumia's claim that Castile had, quote, personal significant involvement in the case while he was in the DA's office. We're joined today by Johanna Fernandez, history professor at Baruch College, CUNY, the City University of New York. Johanna is a coordinator of the campaign to bring Mumia home. Johanna, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Welcome back. You say to me at this very propitious moment.
Yes.
Happy New Year. It's a happy new year. It's a good start.
Johanna, let's start, if you can give us a brief summary of this overall significance of Judge Tucker's recent ruling and mentioning the so-called Williams case.
Judge Leon Tucker of the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas has just made a decision on a case that has been in front of him for over 2 years now. What is significant about the judge's decision is it reverses pretty much 37 years of the court's unwillingness in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal to review all of the violations in his original conviction. So for many, many years, all of the courts in Pennsylvania have denied Mumia the right to hear all of the things that went wrong in the original case. And now, for the first time, a Republican judge has said it appears that there was impropriety and Mumia Abu-Jamal has the right to have the issues he brought up on appeal, which were summarily denied, reheard again.
What was the impropriety? Was it the appearance of impropriety, or was there actual impropriety, and what was it?
Well, it was both the appearance of impropriety, according to Leon Tucker, and impropriety. The impropriety is that Ron Castile, who was first DA of Philadelphia and then became judge in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, made comments in public while he was hearing Mumia's appeals. And what did he say? At some point, he said the then governor of Pennsylvania, William Casey, should send a clear and dramatic message to all cop killers that the death sentence means something. And of course, as you probably know, Mumia is accused, wrongfully accused, of killing a white police officer in Philadelphia. Ron Castile was also funded, his campaign to become judge of Pennsylvania was funded by the Fraternal Order of Police, and the Fraternal Order of Police named him Man of the Year.
I didn't know that.
Now, Johanna, speaking of the Fraternal Order of Police, we have a new sheriff in town, and that would be the new district attorney in Philadelphia, Larry Krasner. What happens next, and what kind of pressure is Krasner facing from the Fraternal Order of Police?
Well, the only thing that will keep Mumia Abu-Jamal from getting his just day in court is Larry Krasner. If Larry Krasner challenges the Republican judge's just opinion, this will, you know, be in a never-ending loop of appeals. Larry Krasner, who is the progressive DA elected by the people of Philadelphia to right the wrongs of his predecessors, is under tremendous pressure from the Fraternal Order of Police. In fact, Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, the police officer that Mumia is was unjustly accused and convicted of killing, was on Fox and Friends this weekend. And she said that she and her people would be meeting with Larry Krasner in the next few days, and that she would report back to Fox and Friends about that conversation.
Michael and Johanna, let's hear some of that audio of Maureen Faulkner from Fox and Friends.
Maureen, can you tell me what your reaction is to what the judge said? Well, I am absolutely outraged with Leon Tucker. My family, the Faulkner family, and I live out in California, and they live in Philadelphia, and we have been back and forth to court in the past year about 7 times in this case, waiting to hear a final judgment on what Leon Tucker was going to make. And of course, he makes it 2 days after Christmas. It always seems like this case is around the holidays. He has no merit on this judgment. I mean, it's just, it was D.A. Castle in 1989 was the district attorney's office. He had nothing to say about Mumia Abdul-Jamal. He had no prejudice towards him. He was just the D.A. at that time. So I don't know how Leon Tucker made this decision.
Yeah, so here's what the judge is saying. The claim of bias, prejudice, and refusal of former Justice Castile to recuse himself is worthy of consideration, as true justice must be completely just, without even a hint of partiality, lack of integrity, or impropriety. Where's the judge coming up with this to suggest there may have been prejudice when it seems like the facts of the case are pretty clear?
I don't know where he's coming up with it. And what's going to happen is this is going to open the door for so many murderers to be able to do this and appeal a situation like this. I'm hoping that Larry Krasner will appeal it, and I will know in the next several days.
So we will obviously be staying on top of that. First of all, I don't want to forget what actually happened to your husband. I don't want you to have to relive it all over again, but I want our viewers to understand. As I understand the facts of the case, your husband's on the job as a Philly police officer and pulls over Jamal's brother for what should have been a routine traffic stop.
That's correct. And my husband asked the brother to get out of the car. He got out of the car and punched Danny in the face. Mm. Danny swung him around and started to frisk him while Mumia Abdul-Jamal was sitting in a taxi cab across the street, ran over, shot my husband in the back. My husband turned and shot him in the chest, fell to the ground, and lost his gun. And that is when Mumia Abdul-Jamal leaned over and emptied his gun into my husband. My husband writhed from side to side as the bullets hit his jacket. And then he leaned down and point blank shot him between the eyes.
Oh, Maureen.
He executed my husband.
I'm so sorry.
And obviously, I'm never going to let this go. I'm never going to let this go. I will continue to speak out, not just for myself, but for all survivors
Absolutely.
That go through this.
And that
I mean, this is a progressive moment that is going on in this country. I don't know what's happening.
Where you're saying judges like this are trying to say, well, maybe we should relook at it. Maybe there was bias. Maybe there was prejudice.
All over the country.
When your husband was shot in cold blood.
Yes, all over the country. They're reducing sentences on murders. They're allowing them out of prison, and it's wrong. It's so wrong.
Maureen, I got to ask you one thing, other thing, which has been going through my mind as I was preparing for the interview, is as you described this routine traffic stop, which became such a tragedy, same thing happened Christmas night with Officer Singh, very similar, in Newman, California. An illegal immigrant comes in and kills him on a routine stop, and there are some Democrats who are not even speaking out about it.
That was a clip from Maureen Faulkner on Fox and Friends.
So this is the kind of pressure that has been placed on not just the current DA, but on all of the judges who've handled this case. So let me give you another example of the kind of pressure exerted by the Fraternal Order Police and Maureen Faulkner. And Maureen Faulkner is, unfortunately, the prop that the Fraternal Order of Police uses, a white woman who's grieving the death of her husband. And they literally fly her in from California to be present at these hearings and to speak to the media. I'm not trying to suggest that Maureen Faulkner didn't suffer. She did. But Maureen Faulkner is living a very comfortable life remarried in California. So what happened in the last day of the hearing? The last day of the hearing, the Fraternal Order of Police, in uniform and not in uniform, all with guns, took over the courtroom. They literally were allowed into the courtroom before the courtroom was opened. They took all of the front seats and left one back row open for the supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the majority of whom are black and people of color. So they are essentially are sending a message to the judge. Meanwhile, did I say that these folks were armed?
You did. And I'm trying to look up quickly whether that's permissible. I thought that if you're not a court officer and you're an officer attending a hearing, you had to check your weapon at the door. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, Mumia presented four different petitions for hearings, appellate hearings, three of which were summarily dismissed, were not even heard, and one of them was heard. So Mumia, according to Judge Leon Tucker, has the right to have all of these hearings and the issues that were presented in these petitions for appellate hearings reheard. What are the issues? Prosecutorial misconduct. The fact that the prosecutor hid evidence from Mumia's attorneys and the jury, namely that there was a fourth person at the crime scene. There is also the issue of judicial bias, that the judge who tried the case originally, Judge Albert Szabo, was overheard saying by a court stenographer, quote, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger." He was speaking to another judge, and he was referring to how he was going to instruct the jury. There was also police testimony that was challenged as false in these hearings. The list of violations in Mumia's case are numerous and scandalous.
Johanna, you are very active with the campaign to bring Mumia home, and we're going to tell listeners how to get in touch with that group and your website. But I wanted to ask about the petition that I understand you are circulating vis-a-vis Maureen Faulkner's pledge to talk to the district attorney, Larry Krasner.
Yes. So essentially, we have a crisis before us, which is that the other side, the Fraternal Order of Police, is pressuring Krasner and apparently might be having a meeting with him. So our recourse is protest through a petition and in the streets. On January 5th, we are having both a celebration and a protest in Philadelphia at noon in front of the DA's office. Most immediately, we have a petition circulating demanding that Krasner do nothing, that he uphold or not challenge the order Leon Tucker rendered on December 27th. So we ask people to go to rootsaction.com and sign the petition. Go to the website rootsaction.com. Look for the Mumia petition to Larry Krasner and sign it. We are trying to get thousands of people to sign this petition, especially people who live in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania.
Johanna, if Krasner grants Maureen Faulkner a meeting, will the campaign push for representatives of our side to have a meeting, sort of equal airtime?
Well, what's fascinating is that we've requested a meeting with the DA on numerous occasions. And yes, we will resubmit the letter we sent Larry Krasner as soon as he took office. Yes, we want a meeting with Larry Krasner. If the Fraternal Order of Police is allowed, the luxury to meet with him, the people of Philadelphia who elected him should have a word with him as well.
Johanna, what is the website for the campaign to bring Mumia home? How can people find out more about your work?
You can go to bringmumiahome.com and you can email us at bringmumiahome@gmail.com. But also, you should go to mobilization4mumia.com. the Philadelphia-based website of the movement to free Mumia. So that is mobilization, the number four, Mumia.com.
Do you have any sense of when Krasner will make a decision about whether to appeal Judge Leon Tucker's decision?
Well, what's interesting is that Leon Tucker has given Mumia Abu-Jamal 30 days to file papers to request a new hearing. So he will have to make a decision within the next 30 days. I imagine that he's going to make the decision within 2 weeks. There's an enormous amount of pressure on him from both sides, and I'm sure he does not want to extend this drama.
Well, Johanna, we will be waiting with bated breath to see what happens. As usual, nothing goes by the book in Philadelphia when it comes to Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Right, exactly. Absolutely nothing. This is truly a victory. This is unprecedented. And part of what a lot of people are asking is, how could this have happened now? Because there is so much madness in the White House, even Republican judges are realizing that they have to draw the line somewhere, or else the entire apparatus over which they preside is going to lose all legitimacy. And then we also have the Black Lives Matter movement, which essentially raised the issue of police homicidal behavior in the United States. But we also had before that the Occupy movement. So even though on the top of society we have folks who are retrograde, consciousness has shifted significantly to the left in the United States in the last 10 years. And Mumia is finally getting his day in court because, as he says, movements change history. How do they change history? They shift consciousness on the ground and make outrageous things like the police department deciding what happens in court unacceptable to American people.
Well, Johanna Fernandez, we so admire your work and the work of all the people that have been supporting Mumia over what's going to be four decades now. He really is the Mandela of the United States. I think this is a real ray of hope for us, and we'll check back with you and get further developments. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on Law and Disorder.
Bye-bye, Johanna.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
American wars undertaken in the Middle East have been raging for an historically unprecedented 17 years, ever since the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. President George W. Bush understood that being a war president would boost his sagging popularity. First, he ordered the attack on Afghanistan on the pretext that it harbored Osama bin Laden and would not give him up. Then, in 2003, with designs on Iraq's oil, the United States of America unleashed an illegal war on that country. It was falsely claimed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and ties with Al-Qaeda. The war involved the bombing of cities and was supposed to be of short duration. Americans were advised that the Iraqi people would welcome the American intervention. Their president, Saddam Hussein, was captured and executed. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed, and hundreds of thousands of people were made refugees. The entire Middle East was destabilized as the war spread under the Obama administration. His Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, planned the aggression against Libya, where its leader, Muammar Gaddafi, was captured and bayoneted to death. The country was destroyed. Clinton said at the time, "We came, we saw, he died." The war was extended to Syria, which the United States had been coveting since World War II. The United States and Israel failed to kill its leader, Bashar Assad, but reduced much of the country to ruins and created thousands of refugees. Then the United States militarily backed and supplied its ally, Saudi Arabia, in its war in Yemen, where 85,000 children have died of starvation. All in all, the United States made war on seven Middle Eastern countries simultaneously. Then 2 weeks ago, fulfilling a campaign promise, President Donald Trump, the commander-in-chief, ordered the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan and Syria. He has been opposed in this by the entire establishment, the military, the media, the intelligence agencies, and both the Republican and Democratic parties. Here to speak with us on this is Ajamu Baraka. Baraka is the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace. He's a former board member of the Center for Constitutional Rights and was the Green Party candidate for vice president in 2016. He writes for Black Agenda Report. Ajamu Baraka, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
We wanted to start with a multi-part question. The USA has been bombing and fighting in Afghanistan for 17 years now, since 9/11. Why did they commence the war? And was it for oil and gas or to pave the way to invade Iraq? And then, was it legal?
Well, you know, it's as a point of controversy. Of course, Afghanistan is seen by many as the justifiable war because of the connection to Osama bin Laden and the attacks on New York City. But we have seen that this was part of a broader strategy, something that we saw emerge with the meetings between the Bush administration authorities and the Taliban in the months before the attack on New York, where basically they were putting pressure on the Taliban to transform their government, to bring in forces that were more friendly to the U.S. And when the Taliban refused, they basically said that now you're in the crosshairs of the U.S. state. So, you know, this was something that was predetermined, I believe, and the attacks in New York was the pretext for the full-blown invasion of Afghanistan. Why were they concerned with Afghanistan? What was the interest? Of course, it's connected to most of the interests in that part of the world related to various pipelines. But in, they also understood, like what the Soviets knew, that there was a tremendous amount of natural resources in that part of the world. Some estimates up to $1 trillion in very valuable resources like iron and copper and cobalt, gold and lithium. So, of course, the interventions are always based on material interests. And so this notion of the U.S. being there for humanitarian reasons to save women and all of those other justifications have not been able to withstand closer scrutiny. Well, the question of its legality, there's no legal justification for the U.S. to invade Afghanistan. The only justification for military activities is given by the United Nations Security Council, and that was not part of that deal, if you will. So it was an illegal invasion.
Why is Donald Trump withdrawing troops from Afghanistan and Iraq? He's opposed by virtually the entire establishment. James Mad Dog Mattis quit his position as Secretary of Defense. Stenty Hoyer, the House Minority Whip, called Trump's announcement of withdrawal from Syria impulsive, irresponsible, and dangerous. And Lindsey Graham said it was a disaster, a stain on the honor of the U.S.
Well, I mean, the national security apparatus is fully committed to the notion of full spectrum dominance. So the strategic concerns that they have are connected to the ability of the U.S. to be able to control and influence events in that part of the world. So the correction that needed to be made once the U.S. was pushed out of Iraq, which meant that they then felt compelled to destabilize and in fact to establish at some point a presence in Syria, became the compelling factor for most of their decisions. The foreign policy traditionalists, they are concerned that by withdrawing troops from Syria, that will undermine their strategy to to isolate Iran, and they see this as, in fact, a disaster. But the Trump forces see the quagmire of both of Syria and Afghanistan as something that needs to be corrected, and therefore that he has been moving in that direction. We have to be very, very critical of this also, because the redeployment of forces from Syria on the ground does not necessarily mean that they're going to be withdrawing their influence and their military activities in Syria. They still have the capacity to engage in bombing campaigns, and there's been evidence to suggest that they are more than willing to continue with those kinds of activities in Syria.
I've read that the United States government has spent $6 trillion, $6 trillion of our tax dollars on the wars in the Middle East since 2001. $6 trillion is 1,000 times a billion, and a billion is 1,000 million. 1,000 times a billion times six. It's hard to even comprehend an amount that's so staggering. What might have been done with this money if it was not used for war?
You know, that question really represents the real crux of the matter when it comes to militarism and the misuse of public resources. That you are absolutely right. That is an obscene figure that has been transferred from the pockets of the public straight into the pockets of the military-industrial complex. People need to understand that this is not $6 trillion that just disappeared into thin air. This $6 trillion represents profits, it represents salaries, it represents a fundamental component of the U.S. economy. And if that money had been used for purposes other than militarism, then the crumbling infrastructure in the U.S. could have been addressed. It could fund free public education through college. We could have affordable housing. We would have a much better health care system if those resources are used to address our real human rights needs. So this is why anti-militarism and, in fact, anti-imperialism becomes such a linchpin in the progressive agenda, that all of the issues that various organizations are working on, housing, health care, you name it, is connected to the misuse and the squandering of public resources connected to the military budget and militarism. And that's why we've been focused on that. So, yes, this $6 trillion that have resulted in death and destruction across the Middle East has resulted in record profits for the military-industrial complex. The U.S. population, and specifically working-class people, are the ones paying the real cost for this kind of adventurism and immorality.
Adjamu, what is the position of the Black Alliance for Peace on these withdrawals?
We support peaceful resolutions of these conflicts. We are anti-militarism and oppose U.S. Military interventions and U.S. imperialism. So if there's real substantive movements toward disconnecting the U.S. from the Syrian conflict and for ending the war in Afghanistan, then we are in support. However, we are, as we said earlier, still watching it very, very closely because we don't necessarily see this as some people characterize it, as sort of a imperial retreat. We see this as imperial shifting, because even though they are shifting away from or trying to shift away from Afghanistan and Syria, we see that their destabilization efforts and militarism in places like Venezuela, Nicaragua, continues unabated. But we are in support of any efforts at this point that appear to be in support of extricating the U.S. From the quagmire, particularly of Afghanistan, but also shifting those 2,000 U.S. Forces that are illegally occupying Syria out of that country.
Let's shift our focus now to Africa and discuss the U.S. military presence on that continent. Can you tell us what U.S. Africa Command is when it was organized, and why?
The U.S. Africa Command was organized October 1st, 2008, as the newest addition of the global U.S. military command structure. The U.S. has basically taken the world and organized it into different regions, different command structures, covering Asia and Europe and South America. So the U.S. Africa Command was their latest addition to formalize their already existing military relationships with various African states, but to formalize that into a formal command structure. From October 1st, 2008 till today, as a consequence of that command structure, we have seen a dramatic expansion of the U.S. military presence on the African continent. In fact, the Black Alliance for Peace, we have documented that there's been something like a 1,900% increase in the military footprint on the African continent. And every place we have seen that there's been an expansion of the U.S. Africa Command, we've seen an uptick in internal subversion, the increased military capacity of these al-Qaeda-related jihadist forces, which is interesting because one would think it would be the other way around, that there would be this uptick of the capacity of these forces, and then the U.S. would come in afterwards. Well, that doesn't really follow in that way in every case. So the Africa Command is something we are opposed to. We believe that it is another weapon being used as part of the U.S. Strategy for countering the influence of the Chinese on the African continent. And so we see this as a process of the recolonization of the African continent through military means.
How many military bases does the United States have in Africa, and where are they?
You know, Michael, that is an interesting question because it depends on how one defines military bases. The U.S. will say they have basically one base in Djibouti. But we know that they have these various military presence throughout the African continent, these forward basing processes, the what we call the lily pads, where you have small bases of rotating U.S. forces. So some have documented up to 84 of these bases on the African continent. Many people were confused and surprised when they heard about the attacks in Niger, where four military personnel were lost their lives. People didn't even know, including members of Congress, that there were forces, U.S. forces, in that country. Well, that's an example of what we see across the African continent. You have these various military forces, primarily special forces, operating in most of the countries on the African continent. Something like 10 operations per day are taking place on the African continent by U.S. military forces.
Yeah, I had read that those forces are in 53 of the 54 African countries. Is that true?
That is true. In every one of those countries, though, there aren't active military activities, but there is military-to-military agreements, and there is military forces from the U.S. in those 53 African countries, yes.
Talk more about what this has to do with China.
Well, the process that we argue, and other people argue also, that this militarization of the African continent is a direct response from the growing influence of the Chinese on the African continent. You know, one can quibble about what the Chinese national interest may be on the African continent, but it's quite clear that the kind of economic activity that we see from the Chinese in terms of investments in infrastructure in these countries is qualitatively different than the investments we see coming from the U.S. and many Western European countries. That instead of making loans available at levels that can be absorbed by these African states through the World Bank or the IMF, We see that basically the intentions of these Western financial institutions was to cripple these countries into debt and to have truncated kinds of economic activities. But with the presence of the Chinese, it gives these African states some degree of leverage to engage in economic activity that's going to be more beneficial to their people. So, you know, the U.S. is pushing militarism and continued subordination of African states, where the Chinese are at least providing some degree of leverage, some degree of space for these African states to exist. So, you know, militarism is the favorite tool being used by the U.S. To try to counteract the growing influence of the Chinese.
Ajama, what has the Congressional Black Caucus done about this? Are they going to hold any hearings?
The Congressional Black Caucus has done virtually nothing on this issue, and that's why we have targeted the Congressional Black Caucus, calling on them, especially now that the Democrats are back in control of the House, for them to in fact to organize hearings on the impact of AFRICOM on the African continent. There's been virtually no research from the U.S. side to see, to look at those connections we've been talking about between increased militarism and increased violence on the African continent. We want the Congressional Black Caucus, that for many years was supposed to be the conscience of the Congress, if you will, that had a special relationship and focus on Africa. We want them to re-embrace that focus and to look critically at U.S. policy on the African continent. And therefore, that's why we have a petition, and we are pushing people to sign that petition to help us to demand that the Congressional Black Caucus, in fact, looks more closely into the activities of the U.S. Government and AFRICOM specifically on the African continent.
We're talking with Ajamu Baraka from Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamu, how do you connect with this petition?
We're asking people to go to our website, blackallianceforpeace.com, to sign the petition, to join the U.S. Out of Africa Network, to engage in grounding themselves in the reality of AFRICOM. But we want people to also understand that the U.S.-Africa campaign to shut down AFRICOM is part of a broader campaign to close all U.S. foreign and NATO bases that we have been an integral part of building a new coalition to do. And we want people to understand the connection between our opposition to AFRICOM and the absolute necessity to close these 800 to 1,000 U.S. foreign bases, and also to look at the foreign bases of NATO. So this is part of a broader campaign that we're organizing. We want people to be aware of that campaign. We want to make this issue of militarism in the U.S. Military budget an issue that will be debated in the upcoming 2020 presidential campaigns.
In our remaining minutes, Ajamu, I wanted to ask you about the Black Alliance for Peace being a founding member of the global campaign against U.S. NATO military bases. 2 months ago, I understand, you participated in an important conference in Dublin, Ireland, concerning U.S. and NATO involvement in Africa, and 36 countries were represented. Can you briefly tell us about it?
Yes, it's a campaign that I referenced a moment ago. The Black Alliance for Peace was an integral part of organizing a new coalition, the coalition to close our U.S. foreign bases. We had a national conference back in January of last year. Conference came out with a commitment to expand our concerns with not only the U.S. Foreign bases, but to connect up NATO foreign bases, and we began to organize an international conference that took place in Dublin, Ireland, in November, where we opened up the conference, and we helped to come out of that conference with an international campaign now to close U.S. and NATO foreign bases. There were representatives from 36 countries at that conference. We had well over 300 participants, and we have a new dynamic global coalition. There's going to be follow-up work in the U.S. In April, in particular April the 4th, where NATO's having their 70th anniversary of NATO, and we're going to be there in force to oppose NATO and to continue to put pressure on the U.S. to close its bases and to close down the African command also.
Could you please tell our listeners one more time how they can reach the Black Alliance for Peace and connect with you?
Please go to our website, blackallianceforpeace.com, and to support us. We are trying to wage the struggle in the U.S. With meager resources. We don't get any money and don't solicit the money from foundations. We depend on individuals who believe that we can rebuild an anti-war movement in this country to support us. So please go to our website, get more information on our AFRICOM campaign, but get more information on the campaign to close our U.S. foreign bases and to help us to make this issue of militarism and anti-imperialism something that so-called progressive candidates can no longer avoid in the context of U.S. politics. So please help us rebuild this anti-war movement in the U.S., and let's make this place a place where not only can we live a more humane life in this country, but we can put a break on U.S. imperialism that is responsible for suffering and death and destruction globally.
Ajamu Baraka, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and we wish you a most peaceful 2019.
And a productive one. You take it easy, Ajamu. Thanks for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
So long.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.